Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think this area has changed remarkably, at least here in Bloomington, in the last few years, where customers aren't always looking for perfection in produce.
Marcia Veldman coordinates Bloomington's bustling farmers market. She's with us today talking about food justice, ugly produce, and about her addiction to growing food. Why the USDA wants to change how it defines the occupation of farmer. Frank Nykos shows me around his indoor farm where he grows everything from coffee beans to ginger and then sea veggies in a salad prepared by Chef Daniel Orr. Food headlines our reporters kept an eye on this week with Luann Johnson.
Hummus lovers, in case you missed it, Sabra announced a recall of some products last week after a sample tested positive for listeria. As NPR reported, the products are predominantly the classic variety of the hummus. We've posted the article that includes all the info for affected products at eartheats.org. Click on this week's podcast post. Some good news for honeybees. Well, sort of. A Purdue University investigation found that about 29% of Indiana's honeybees died off this past winter. That's down from nearly 65% in 2013, one of the largest bee die-offs on record. Purdue University entomologist Greg Hunt conducted the investigation and says this year's die-off is more in line with long-term trends. Close to 5 million colonies existed in the 1940s, compared to 2.5 million colonies today. From insecticides to parasites, a variety of stressors are said to contribute to the honeybee's decline. But Hunt says it's difficult to measure just how much these factors are affecting the bees. And rainy weather, especially in southern Indiana, has delayed the planting of corn crops in the state. But agronomists say the delay shouldn't have a major financial impact on Hoosier farmers. Purdue agronomy professor Robert Nielsen says historical data doesn't show a strong correlation between planting dates and crop yields. The planting date is only one of many factors that influence yield, and that by itself is not a great predictor. He says the frustration farmers are feeling has more to do with impatience. He warns that farmers who plant too soon could cause soil compaction, as heavy machinery pushes down on soil that hasn't properly dried. That limits root development and total yield. Too wet in Indiana and still too dry in California. We're posting lots of stories on Twitter that analyze the drought. The latest? How much are almonds to blame for the water shortage? Join the conversation at Earth Eats.
Luann Johnson makes it happen for us every week. Thank you.
Yep, see you next week.
When President Obama announced late last year that he would work toward ending the embargo on trade with Cuba, it wasn't just tourists perking up their ears. Midwest farmers and ranchers see communist Cuba as an untapped market for goods from the American heartland. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted has the story.
On a clear, cold day in southeast Missouri, Paul Combs pulls up to some workers loading rice into bins for shipping. The land here is saturated with water, which makes it perfect for growing rice. He rolls down his window.
Why don't you pick a warm day to grow rice? Load rice.
Hey, it's better than last year.
Today, Combs arranges to get his workers an extra bin to pack up more of the rice. It's something he says will have to happen more often in the future if they can start exporting to one particular Caribbean island with a large appetite for rice.
We're excited about the possibility of normalized relations with Cuba. Until 1963, Cuba was the biggest market for U.S. rice.
Combs says some of his rice ends up in milling operations stateside. It's milled into rice flour and rice bran that you find on grocery store shelves. Anheuser-Busch snaps up some of Combs' rice, too, for beer. The rest of the bins get loaded onto barges and shipped down the Mississippi River where they head out of the country.
And the primary markets for that export market are Mexico and in all of the countries in Central America.
Right now, Cuba imports tons of rice from Asia. Since Cuba sits smack dab in the middle of a busy U.S. trade route, American farmers think they can supply higher quality rice at a cheaper price than what the Cubans are currently buying from Vietnam. And cheap is the name of the game for an island with a big import market. Bill Messina is an agriculture economist at the University of Florida.
They're a small country, but they're having to import over 60% of their food
requirements to feed the population.
Messina says in 2014, Cuba imported more than $2 billion worth of food products, much of which is bought in bulk from countries in Asia or South America. But Cuba doesn't have a ton of space to store extra crops, which could be an incentive to buy American.
It's secure and dry. Warehouse storage facilities make it much more difficult for them to be importing large volumes like that than smaller volumes that they could purchase from the United States.
The U.S. has been able to export a limited amount of food to Cuba under a deal President George W. Bush made. But many commodity groups are calling for a full end to the trade embargo. They want complete access to all of Cuba's market. But that takes an act of Congress.
We always are looking for opportunities, whether it is in Asia or whether it's 90 miles from our shore to sell more beans or rice or corn or pork or poultry.
Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri visited Cuba recently. She says the U.S. is the only country not openly trading with Cuba, and it's time to drop the embargo, which would not only help American producers, but Cuban citizens, too.
The Castro government is using the American embargo as an excuse to the people of Cuba to explain their lack of prosperity. It's time we rip away that excuse.
Back in Missouri, rice farmer Paul Combs drives back to his office, eager to ramp up rice exports.
Is it going to be as big a market as it was in 63 when it first opens? Maybe, maybe not.
He says American rice could act as the gateway commodity for the rest of the agriculture industry.
As time goes on, if their economy improves because of increased tourism, then maybe you start to sell them the higher-priced agricultural products like beef from Missouri or pork from Missouri.
Indeed, the National Chicken Council, American Soybean Association, and the U.S. Cattlemen's Association are among dozens of commodity groups pushing for an end to the embargo. They hope their products are next in line. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Another story coming up from Harvest about a loophole that allows some farms to collect big subsidy payments. A conversation today for the 41st season of the City of Bloomington's Community Farmers Market. At the peak of the season, the market will house well over 100 farm and prepared food vendors. Marcia Veldman is the market's coordinator.
I love the connectedness of knowing where my food came from. It just, you know, knowing the people who raised it, it makes it feel special to have a meal.
I spoke with her in 2013 after she was named Bloomington, Indiana's Woman of the Year. Marcia is also a grower. Her farm is Meadowlark Farms. She's been growing food since she was a little girl, and one of her first aha moments came when her neighbor plucked one of his coxcomb flowers for her to look at.
And he asked me to hold out my hand and kind of tipped the flower over, and some seeds fell into my hand. And that was like my first realization that I didn't have to buy seeds in a packet, that they didn't come out of packets.
When I talk to people who gardened or farmed as a kid with their families, a lot of them say, I needed a break, I had to take a step back, I worked too hard as a kid and I hated it. And then they eventually come back to it a little bit later in life. But it sounds like you've just had it in your blood this whole time.
I have. Yeah. Yeah. It sometimes feels a little bit like an addiction. But for the most part, I think it's a healthy addiction. Although sometimes when I'm standing up from the ground and it's taking me a while to straighten out my knees, I kind of wonder, is the extent I'm doing a healthy addiction?
The first line in your bio says you're an advocate for food justice.
Mm-hmm.
What is food justice?
Food justice, you know, it for me kind of, I guess, encompasses food from the time it's being grown in the fields to when it's on our plates. And it involves creating a healthful place for people who are growing the food, you know, so that the people who are raising the food we eat aren't exposed to chemicals that are harmful to them, that they receive a fair wage for the labor that they do, and continues on to that healthy food is accessible to everyone, that that's a right.
You can speak to this next question from two angles. One as a grower, one as the coordinator of the farmers market. Talk about the difficulties
for small local farmers as they're trying to get their food to local tables?
There's quite a few challenges in that. You know, one, just the unpredictability of weather, and you just never know from season to season how a particular crop is going to fare, you know. So one year, say you plant an acre of sweet potatoes and you have like way more than you can use or sell. And then the next year you plant that same amount and you're running out in October. So yeah, it's very unpredictable crops. And then when you start talking about perishable items, that gets even more tricky because, you know, with something like sweet potatoes, well, you can sell them the next week and, you know, come up with other game plans. When you're talking about tomato, you've got a short window to get it to where it needs to be. And inevitably, you're going to have times where the plants are at their most productive and all of a sudden you're kind of like, woo, I've got a whole bunch of green beans. You know? So there's that aspect. And then we did also talk a little bit about customer expectations. Well, I think this area has changed remarkably, at least here in Bloomington, in the last few years, where customers aren't always looking for perfection in produce, but also in their looking at it from a different perspective and, you know, wanting to focus more on seasonality and not, you know, looking for sweet corn in May, that they kind of get that. Mm-hmm. Regulations can be challenging, and, you know, I'm not anti-regulation by any means because I think it's important for food safety that we do have good, sound regulations, but all too often they aren't scale appropriate, so they are more focused on these big, huge produce farms and not on small scale farms like the ones that are selling at the farmers market.
For people looking at the Bloomington Farmers Market as sort of the goal that they want to achieve in their community, give some tips, tricks, advice.
We get a lot of inquiries from people who are interested in starting farmers markets in their communities or trying to build on the markets they have. And while I think there's a lot of good things that can be learned from our community market, one, I think it does need to be kind of specific to the needs of a community. This market didn't start this way. And that's important to remember. It started with 23 vendors, and it's taken time to grow. And I think that's something that people starting in a market need to understand.
Patience.
Patience. Like, mm-hmm. Yes. Patience. Farming and farmers markets are both about patience.
Marcia Veldman is the farmers market coordinator for the city of Bloomington. The market will again be offering its Double Market Bucks program in 2015. That means, for instance, $3 in SNAP benefits will give you $6 in market bucks to spend at farm vendors. We'll post more information about this program on our Twitter feed at Earth Eats. Our recipe today, not so local, at least not to Indiana. It uses seaweed, also called hijiki. Daniel Orr soaked it overnight.
It looks a lot like giant grains of wild rice. It should taste sweetly of the sea, but it shouldn't taste like a mud pond. And when you mix all these other ingredients with it, it'll taste very familiar.
Also on this ingredients list, daikon radishes.
A lot of times when you go to Japanese restaurants, you'll have pickled daikon on your sushi platter. So a lot of times it's pickled, it's yellow colored. So I'm just going to cut a julienne of this. Okay, to that I'm going to add some julienne peppers, a cup of shredded carrots, a cup of cucumber julienne, and then some nice white bean sprouts. All right, to those vegetables, I'm going to add some herbs. I've got some Thai basil, kind of staying with that Asian theme. And it's got that anisey basil aroma to it. And I've got some scallions and mint that I'm going to add. And we're just going to make the vinaigrette right on top of that. Olive oil, juice of two limes, I'm going to put just a little bit of honey, about a couple teaspoons, and that's going to counterbalance that lime, the sourness of the lime. Then we've got some wonderful Chinese chili paste with garlic. I'm going to put about a tablespoon of that in there. All right, I'm going to toss this together just with my hands. Okay, we're going to give that a little taste. Hmm. Garnish it with a little bit of crab meat. And who could say no to that?
Nice. See the picture and the recipe at eartheats.org. Coming up, why throw veggie bits in the compost bin when there's still so much life left in them?
And if it doesn't work, you know, it was waste anyway. It was going to go in the compost, so why not, you know, see what happens?
Frank Nikas plants food he buys at the grocery store with some incredible results. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats again. Welcome back. I'm Annie Corrigan. We had Brad Dunn on the show a couple weeks ago talking about navigating the confusing and sometimes misleading world of wines. I pulled a couple additional thoughts from that interview with Brad to share with you today.
Talk about a misconception in the wine industry. Screw caps are awesome.
Brad is the sommelier at the Uptown Cafe.
And the reason, another misconception, is not because we're killing cork trees. Cork is actually renewable. So I think it has more to do with the fact that when it's being shipped halfway around the world, it stays really fresh with the screw cap. And especially in the case of Sauvignon Blanc and in a lot of screw cap wines, they're not really meant for aging. They're meant to be consumed, you know, within 1 to 3 years.
Okay, so screw caps are just fine. Wines he's especially hot on these days? Well, it's him and much of the wine industry, he says. Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand. Next time you enjoy a glass, here are some flavors to keep in mind.
And, you know, Sauvignon Blanc runs the range. Some of it is oaked, but most of it isn't. Most of it is really fresh, and you get lots of really nice lime and gooseberry. Grass is, of course, a very common descriptor for Sauvignon Blanc. And then the weird one is cat pee, which is a common one of those nerdy wine descriptors. In the way that barnyard is like that earthy funkiness, I mean, it's subtle, but if you smell it, it's unmistakable. So you have all these fruit flavors, but then hanging out in the background, especially French. I mean, French like stinky cheese and all sorts of stinky things. So if it has just a hint of that earthiness to it, that's what they're talking about.
Brad Dunn talks about spirits on occasion here on Earth Eats, and he'll be back the first week of May to talk tequilas and mezcals.
Cheers.
Big farms are raking in taxpayer dollars they haven't necessarily earned by taking advantage of a loophole in the law. As Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell reports, closing the loophole isn't easy.
The government pays farmers billions of dollars a year in farm subsidies. The payments are meant to stabilize the food system by supporting farmers during tough times. That helps keep food plentiful and relatively cheap. The Farm Service Agency regulates these payments, and in order to qualify for a check, you have to meet the FSA's definition of a farmer. Levi Grohl fits. On a sunny Saturday afternoon, he's in his barn sporting Carhartts and work boots caked in mud.
There's multiple branches to farming. You have to be a mechanic, weatherman, and then work in the dirt, planting something.
For farmers like Grohl, the FSA's guidelines are clear. Own land or equipment or invest in the farm? Check. Do 1,000 hours of labor a year? Double check. Grohl farms full-time in western Illinois, growing row crops, raising hogs, and solving problems.
Yeah, come on!
We'll start.
But not all farmers are so obvious. Some look more like businessmen, and they're eligible for subsidies too. The FSA calls this group farm managers. What's farm management?
Well, that's the big rub.
Craig Cox is with the Environmental Working Group. He says the FSA's current guidelines for management are too loose. Some managers spend just a few hours a year working on farm business.
This loophole has made a real estate agent in Chicago that makes a couple of phone calls a year eligible for farm payments.
It's called the actively engaged loophole, and it's been gaping for nearly 30 years. The FSA currently limits payments to $250,000 a year for a farmer and his spouse. Most farms never come close to hitting that ceiling, but some big farms do. And that's where the loophole problem comes in. Bumping up against the limit? Add people to the payroll, and the limit rises.
Some farm operations organize themselves so that there's sometimes 10 or 20 people that are considered providing active personal management and therefore eligible for farm subsidies.
The Government Accountability Office tracks government spending of taxpayer dollars. The GAO investigated the loophole. It concluded that the FSA's loose guidelines make it easy for big farms to collect big payments while doing little work. For example, one GAO report cites a family farm in the Midwest that received $400,000 in subsidies in a single year. Among the 11 recipients were a 16-year-old who was allegedly helping run the business and an 88-year-old whose home address was in South Florida.
There has been this so-called management loophole for some years now.
Val Dolcini heads the Farm Service Agency. Here are the new rules the agency drew up. Farms are limited to a maximum of 3 managers. Managers have to do at least 500 hours of work a year, and they have to document it. If the FSA adopts these rules, Dolcini says they could save taxpayers $50 million over the next 3 years. But that's just a tiny fraction of total subsidy payments.
We're proposing a rule that tightens up that loophole and really makes it much clearer around who can receive a farm payment and who cannot. And we feel like it's a strong rule.
I'm disappointed. This really does not accomplish what I want to accomplish.
Chuck Grassley is the senior senator from Iowa. He authored the amendment that instructed the FSA to propose new rules. But the results don't go as far as he'd like. The issue? Congress exempted family farms from the rules. Family farms make up about 97% of all farms in the country.
So do you think that now it's kind of like the family farmer loophole?
The answer is yes. They gutted it. So it probably is going to apply to 1 or 2% of the farmers.
How much money are taxpayers losing to this new loophole? The FSA does not have an estimate. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
The reporting crew at Harvest produces stories about food and farming in America. Read and listen to more of their stories at harvestpublicmedia.org. Pulling up to Frank Nikas's house, you can tell he's a gardener. His yard is full of raised beds and rows of last year's crops. When I visited in early March, he hadn't yet started his preparations for spring planting because it had been too cold and even a bit snowy. But inside his house, that was a different story. His living room is jam-packed with plants on shelves, and I mean floor to ceiling. This is the ultimate indoor container garden. There's lemongrass and sprouting quinoa, some sunchokes. Those aren't so unusual. It's the small tree over there by the sliding door that's really caught my attention.
Yeah, this is a coffee tree.
He pulls a red cherry off a branch to reveal 2 small coffee beans. He grew this from a cutting he received from a coworker, which makes the coffee tree different from almost everything else growing in here. Like the ginger and beets and lemongrass, most of these plants were started from food he bought at the grocery store. He planted the carrots and the celery the same way.
But all you got to do is just leave, I left, maybe 3-4 inches. And then you just stick it right in the dirt.
And eventually you'll get new celery ribs popping up. The carrots will just grow more greens, but those are edible. The pots with the lettuce aren't looking so good.
Now the problem with lettuce is that once it's large enough to go into the grocery store, a lot of times it's ready to go into the bloom cycle.
Which means you won't get a lot of new growth, but there are a few new shoots that could be plucked for a tiny salad. It's obvious that this has grown far beyond a simple hobby, but it all started because of one thing.
It's just curiosity.
And curiosity has fueled him since he was young.
I remember when I was a kid, my grandmother put a stick in the ground, just a plain old stick, to prop up her tomatoes, and the stick grew.
One day, it had leaves. Around that same time, he got the idea to plant food from the grocery store. First experiment, grapefruit seeds.
And we cut into it, and it had sprouting seeds in it for some reason. And I'm old. They didn't have packaged dirt back then, so I went out in the garden, got some dirt, and planted them up. And I had a tree for well over 20 years.
Changes come slowly in Frank's garden, and he seems to like it that way. But he's starting to think about his end game. In the coming years, he says he'll be relying on his container garden to fill the gaps in his income.
And I knew that, you know, I probably wasn't going to have a lot of savings, and Social Security's not going to pay for everything. And what little bit that the nursery will bring in will be a help.
He sees possibilities with the giant tubs of ginger. He dumps them out, dirt and all, to show me the biggest tangle of ginger root I've ever seen. Sure enough,
I didn't replant it.
There's no way he could eat all of this, so he's giving some of it away, and maybe he'll also make some money off it. This is the result of 6 years of growth, and it all started with a tiny toe of ginger he bought from the store. And, of course, some curiosity.
And if it doesn't work, you know, it was waste anyway. It was going to go in the compost, so why not, you know, see what happens.
Last pot to show me is in the kitchen, one of his newest plantings that has taken him full circle. It's a tiny grapefruit plant. Thanks to Frank Nikas for showing me around his indoor gardening paradise. I snapped some pictures and have shared those on the website, eartheats.org. Tweet us shots of your container garden. We're at Earth Eats. The hardworking staff at Earth Eats includes Aya Bonbinder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for listening. Earth Eats over and out. I'm Annie Corrigan.